Hello, everyone. This is Sarah McCoy. Welcome to Bookmarked with Sarah McCoy on our monthly radio show that we do. We're here today with novelist John Burnham Schwartz, who has just published a gorgeous historical novel called The Red Daughter. And as you all know from listening to my show, I am a historical fiction fanatic. So this is really exciting for me to be able to welcome him and to hear about the book and to share him with all of you. You all might know some of my guest's work. He is quite famous. He is a New York Times bestseller, and his novel Reservation Road became a movie, which I have seen, and I had seen before I knew I'd be talking to John, so it was a while back, and I loved that movie. Actually, they play it quite often on TV, don't they, John? I feel like I see it all the time on, like, on the weekends.
I only sort of know occasionally if a residuals check shows up.
Oh, well.
Every so often in the mail. But, yeah, it does seem to show on TV. I've seen it also. Planes now are a place where movies
yes
get circulated, so that's kind of nice.
It is so good. It is and such a good novel. And now you have out The Red Daughter, and that just came out on April 30th, correct?
That is right. I am on tour as we speak.
Wonderful. Now, do you want to give us a brief synopsis, or do you want me to try my hand at it?
I will give it a try, but I'd sort of to set that up, I would just sort of start with two events that 45 years apart that made me want to write the novel, and then we can get into how that opened up into the larger story.
Right.
But in 1967, in April, the only daughter and only surviving child of Joseph Stalin, a woman named Svetlana Aleluyeva, who was 40 years old at the time and the most famous woman in the Soviet Union, within the Soviet Union, defected to the West. And just to give some idea, it was certainly one of the most momentous events of the Cold War, and she was and remains the most significant Soviet citizen ever to defect to the West. And one sign of the insanity that awaited her, even though many of us, you know, may not remember any of this now, is when she arrived at JFK Airport in April of 1967, there were more reporters and more people waiting for her than there had been to greet the Beatles 3 years before. Mm. And so that's just a small indication of how she was met. She also had brought with her a memoir that she had written a few years before. She received $1.5 million for that publishing deal, which was the largest memoir contract ever, except for Churchill's. Became an international bestseller, and for a while she was one of the more celebrated people around anywhere. So take that moment for what it is, and then skip ahead 45 years, maybe less historic, but I'm sitting in my house in Brooklyn in late November 2011, and I pick up the New York Times in the morning, and there on the front page is a huge headline that says Lana Peters, which was the third name in her life that she used. Lana Peters, Stalin's daughter, dead at 85. Mm. And I start to read the obituary, and the obituary writer leaps in and says her life was so extraordinary, it reads like a Russian novel.
Mm.
I hadn't even realized that she was still alive, so I was shocked to see she was dead, and I hadn't thought about her in any way for decades. But I start to read, and her life indeed was extraordinary. I mean, truly remarkable and surprising, shocking even in certain ways. Mm. And then I got to the inside page, and there was a photograph, and literally, you know, my heart caught because I recognized the photograph, and I recognized the woman in it, who was Svetlana at age 40, 41, I guess she just turned. I recognized the other person in the photograph standing next to her on the tarmac at JFK, surrounded by microphones, and that was my father.
I get chills.
So my father had been the young lawyer who'd been sent over in the middle of the night under CIA cover to Switzerland, where she was in hiding in a convent under high security because there was real concern that she might be assassinated by the Soviets on Swiss soil. And he'd been sent over to fetch her. He had a false passport, and so did she. And when the next morning he walked into a back room of the Zurich airport, there she was. And together they stepped onto the plane as a fake married couple, Mr. and Mrs. Stalin.
Wow.
And they get on the plane in first class. Those were the days. Not like book tour. So,
right.
right. So immediately orders martinis, and they take off. And he's they're halfway across to the States and no one knows where she is, supposedly, or no one's supposed to know. And he gets called up to the cockpit, and he goes in to see the pilot, who's irate. He's just discovered over the radio who he's carrying. He's carrying Stalin's daughter.
Mm.
And now the news is out for the whole world. And so at that point, it is in those hours that all the people gather at JFK. Meanwhile, as they're flying, she turns to my father and she tells him that he reminds her of her dead brother, Yakov, who is the one brother she really loves.
So now, is this the story your father told you about?
This is a story that I knew just the particulars, the rough outline of, because when I was two in 1967, she arrived and she came and stayed with us that summer.
Oh my gosh.
And then over the next, 8 or 9 years, while he represented her, he was her lawyer, friend, and closest advisor. She would come and stay with us every so often, and she was, in our lives. And
that's
and then he stopped representing her. She was, as you'll discover, a challenging client, to say the least. But he continued to get letters from her over the years, but we never talked about her again.
Wow.
And so when I, after reading this obituary the next morning, I began work on the Red Daughter. I contacted him and he opened a file of his. He's just retired as a lawyer after all these years. And he opened his large Svetlana file for me, and there were years and years of letters. She continued to write him over the years. There were, unusual documents. There were facts that I hadn't seen anywhere else and wouldn't see. And so that was a wonderful, avenue to follow as I began to get into the story. And, the two facts of the story that are the sort of pillars of how I went forward over the years to write it. One is a fact, which is Svetlana Aleluyeva, was the daughter of a man responsible for the death of more than 20 million of his own people. It's just a fact, but you have to really chew it over to get the full effect, in a way, of what that might mean. Yeah, he was, at the head of the entire Soviet Union. He was a cult of personality in every single room, in every single public building, and often private. There was a photograph or a painting of him.
And I bet
she was his daughter.
As a real person, what a burden. What a burden to carry.
Right. And so, she would spend her entire life looking for a home and trying to find a sense of self that was her own, and trying to show the world and herself that she was not her father's daughter. And she would make extraordinary and extreme decisions in her life as a result of that. She would never succeed, but she never stopped trying. And I think for me, as I came to know her and her story, that persistence, that need to keep struggling to find it, held its own kind of wonder.
Right.
And it still does.
You're celebrating a woman's life and voice that at the time was unheard and unable to be heard. She couldn't speak up about possibly the things that she felt deep down truly. And so you've given her that voice all these years later. Now, one thing I was curious about is your balance of and I get asked this question all the time, especially on book tour from readers, is how do you balance the fact and the fiction? And what does that even mean? I even my co-host here, who I usually am on the air with, he doesn't understand historical fiction. He's like, that's a paradox there. And I agree with him. Like the label is a paradox. And so how do you balance this real life woman and yet making up her narrative action?
So I took two avenues in to try and get inside the story, because of course that's what fiction does. You know, that's what fiction does better than any other art form, is to reveal the interiority of characters and their experiences. And so the two windows for me, one was the role of my father. Not so much, not my father himself, but the role that he played. Someone who went over, became close to her, came into the country with her, brought her into the country, and was there beside her as all of these things were happening. I extrapolated that idea to extend not just for 10 years, as it did in my father's case, but to extend over decades for the rest of her life. I added to it, there is a romantic element between them in the book that's difficult and challenging, but nonetheless there, that certainly did not, I should point out for the record, did not exist.
I was going to ask that. When you mentioned the letters earlier, I almost threw in there, those were platonic letters. Those were not love letters.
There's an author's note at the end that I spent quite a lot of time
on,
in which delineates all that. But that's certainly that relationship between the lawyer in the novel named Peter Horvath and Svetlana is the biggest fictionalization, I would say, in some ways, of all the characters and the facts. The other side is her voice. I read more than three dozen books about her and about Stalin and the times and all the letters I could find and everything else. There's a good biography of Svetlana that came out 5 or 6 years ago called Stalin's Daughter. It's very good. It's straightforward. And of course, I devoured it for my own purposes. But I would say that by the end, I felt almost sorry for the biographer, because she was fundamentally yoked to Svetlana's actual voice, both as it was written over three memoirs and as it was expressed verbally and through letters. You could see, especially in the second half of her life, as she expressed herself mostly in English, how her voice kind of went from being an open hand to a closed fist to a clenched fist, that became more extreme in its expressions, more dogmatic, more, you know, almost paranoid in certain cases. And so I felt that voice was not, in a way, commensurate in its expressiveness with the life that I came to understand she really led. And the reason for that is there are many historical novels that seek to evoke or portray an entire period. We're going to give you the political situation, and we're going to give you the social fabric and the landscape and what it was like and the economics and the culture. This is not that kind of historical novel. It is, though it covers an entire life, 85 years, and it covers an immense amount of territory in that regards, both in time and in place. It is essentially an emotional and psychological evocation of her life. And the reason for that is because that, as I understand it, is how she experienced her life. She was not a political person, despite the fact of the historic, you know, marking of her defection. She was not a shrewd person. She had no agenda. She was driven by emotional impulses and needs, sort of feelings of abandonment and powerlessness from her childhood that never left her. And it's impossible really to understand the extreme, almost shocking decisions she made that are, you know, expressed in the book and rendered in the book without understanding the emotional and psychological underpinnings for how she saw the world. And so that's how I tried to shape the book. You know, if you open the book, you open it to an editor's foreword, and that is written by Peter Horvath. And you come to understand both how he met her, how he brought her into the country, but also how, because he's in his 80s now and he's widowed and alone, and you realize that he tells you how he came in possession of what you are about to read, which are, after her death, he received in the novel these notebooks of hers, these 28 journals, and these were the unpublished journals of her life. Now, they're fictionalized.
Right.
Of course, they're fictional. They didn't exist. I wrote them. But they cover from the first day of her arrival in America to the end of her life.
And then
we enter in, and that's what we read through much of the book.
Right. And I thought that was such a brilliant format that you used because, as you said earlier perfectly, I tell people, too, when I'm out on book tour, historical fiction is about, what, like you said, the interior of history. So that the interior of history are the emotions. And I think, if we want facts and figures and if people want that, they can go and they can open an actual history book and they can read the dates and the events. And it's very static. And that is what happened. But if I feel personally, and it sounds like you are of the same conviction, that if you want to actually know, if you want to actually feel, if you want to actually understand, I think that's the key there, to understand a period and what was going on during that time in history, you have got to go into the people and what they were feeling during that time and how
I think that's right.
Yeah, and how they were perceiving the events around them. That's important because all of that is really why the events took place and how they were then dealt with during that time. That's more interesting than the actual event or the actual historical fact.
I think we end up, in the end, from the writer's side and ultimately, I hope, from the readers, making a certain kind of distinction between truth and fact. And people might often ask, even after they've read the book, well, what was true and what was made up? And, the truth is, or the fact is that there are a lot of facts, myriad facts, countless facts that are in the book, but that oftentimes a novelist, certainly in my own case, doesn't use them as an end product. It's not a finished thing because it's a fact. It actually is just a starting point.
Right.
It's an opening. And so you use that detail in order to, you know the attachment of the person to that detail in real life. But what you're really trying to do is that helps you locate the person in the arc of the story, but you're trying to use it as a window to get into a room and make a scene. And ultimately, it's a room in which you're interested in the truth, the emotional truth of the time and the character, rather than the fact of it. But it's the detail that allows you to get there, because the detail still has the emotional or psychological residue on it of the character in real life. And so it's a stepping stone or an entry point. And again, that's part of the joy of doing research as a fiction writer.
Right.
And, it is factually true, but in the end, that's not the destination.
Right. And I think I always try to tell people that I am trying to capture, the zeitgeist, really, the spirit of a people, a place, a time period. And if my readers and your readers, if they walk away and they feel that they know the spirit of Svetlana, then that really, you have made your goal. And that is the point of it. And if you understand the struggle of this young woman who, to me, 41 is young. So this young woman. Who,
I'm not throwing any stones either.
Yeah, so for her to go to be the daughter of this man who really is a villain of history to many, that, wow, where do you go from that? How do you break out and become your own person? I thought it was interesting you said, and I didn't know this at the beginning, that she had, it was her third name, Lana was her third name?
Yeah, so she was born Svetlana Stalina, Stalin's daughter, and then after he died in 1953, she changed her name to her mother's maiden name, Aleluyeva. And then later on, I don't want to give away too much from the book or her life, but she marries a man in America named Peters, and she becomes, actively Americanizes her name.